Right, so we did 12:17 through 13:1-2 last week, and what we looked at was, you know, Satan was pretty angry at the fact that he was thrown out of heaven. He couldn't destroy the church, and so he just asked the question, "Man, what's an enraged dragon to do?" Well, I'll tell you what. Now that I'm find myself here on this earth permanently, I don't have the privilege of or the freedom to go, come and go as I please to the heavenly realms, and I'm stuck and banished here. I'm going to make a mess of this place. I'm going to get everybody in place in order to destroy everything. Yeah, he's like, man, I'm going to make a mess of this place. Every single time I can find an individual Christian, I'm going to get my ducks in a row, and I'm going to create a system that is designed to attack them and to destroy their faith. That is my goal. That is what I want to do. And that is exactly what he's done. Because Satan is finite. He's not everywhere. He can't see into your mind. He can't read your thoughts. He's not everywhere all at once. He doesn't have all wisdom. He is a finite creature like you and I. Now, he's obviously more powerful and some of the stuff that he can do. Doesn't forget stuff, greater intelligence, all that kind of thing. You know, has the whole immortal thing going on. And he's got billions in his network that report back to him, and he organizes them and makes everything happen. You can see that through the scripture, that there's certain terms that are used to describe the different levels of organization that is there in the, specifically the demonic realm. You have some demons, they seem to be more high level, that are over specific locations and over specific leaders of locations. So I am pretty confident that there is a demon that is, say, you know, the demon over New York, the demon over London, the demon over Washington, D.C., and, you know, they settle their influence and have their minions working and, you know, orchestrating. I don't know how that happens. I don't know what influence they have, how it works. It just seems that's to be the case. And God, if you listen to the new Cat CPR episode, we get into some of that stuff, the whole Nephilim, Book of Enoch thing. God purposely doesn't give us a lot of information about the angelic realm. And I think that's on purpose. Because look what people have done with the limited amount of information that they have had. They get super obsessed with it, engrossed in it, and they want to find out things because it's this spiritual, powerful realm that they want to be able to have all of these, you know, concepts from and understand. God purposely doesn't tell us. And I think that's on purpose. He doesn't want us to mess with it. We have enough to keep us busy here, don't we? We have enough to learn. We have enough to worry about. We have enough to focus on being faithful in this life. And we've got a job to do of seeking and saving the lost, of glorifying God. And I'll tell you what, if we spend all this time trying to research the, you know, things like the Nephilim or the Book of Enoch and the demonic realm, and how much time is that going to take away from the things that matter, the things that we're supposed to do? That's why, you know, I like conspiracy theories, but I tell you what, they can be a major distraction if we don't limit our exposure to stuff like that. So we, again, they're fun, you know. I definitely spend some time looking at that because you can take those things and bring them back to a spiritual component and use it for some encouragement, but it's not the focus. Anyway, Satan creates, we're introduced to two of the three agents that Satan uses to wage war against the saints. The two that were introduced here in chapter 13 is the beast from the sea, which is tyrannical demonic government. And we're introduced to the beast out of the earth, which is the false prophet, which is false religion. Looks like a lamb, speaks like a dragon. Haven't gotten to that one yet, but we will. And then we get introduced to the harlot, the seduction that is placed over the beast, that controls the beast out of the sea, controls the tyrannical government, and calls the shots, essentially. You know? Because the purpose of all of this is to bring worship back and submission back to the beast, or sorry, to the dragon. And what better way to do that than for people to be engaged in all of the things that the dragon likes to do and give him praise through doing that, right? So that's what the goal is. So we've been in the middle of talking about the dragon, or sorry, the beast out of the sea, the tyrannical government. And we spent time last week and we looked at he had 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems. Remember, on the head of the dragon were the crowns, on the horns are the crowns, on the beast. Simply put, the dragon is in control. He's the intelligence behind it. The power behind it belongs to the beast that comes out of the sea. He is the powerful one that implements he's the powerful one that implements the agenda. He's the one that has been given the power to move things forward here. Now, we also saw in verse 2 that he contains this specific beast is like the beast that come out of Daniel chapter 7, but instead of individual governments, it looks like this is a conglomeration of all of them. So this is more than just a single government, it seems. It appears to be a personification of all anti-Christian, all anti-God governments, enemies of God's people that have existed throughout time. That's what it appears to be. And we'll get a little bit more into that today as we move forward, because we're going to be here and we're going to be in Revelation 17 a little bit because of this next passage we're going to go through. Now, one of the things that we see at the end of verse 2, middle of verse 2, he says, "And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority." And then also at the end of verse 1, this is one of the things I want to mention, on his head were blasphemous names. This just tells you the character. You know, I mean, there's a much bigger thing now that's happened in our society as of late that wasn't really around when, I'm sure it was a little bit, when I was growing up. And that's everybody with the face tattoos, right? A lot of people have the face tattoos. Why would you want to have something on your face versus, say, someplace else? You know, well, you want it to be seen. It's something important to you. It's something you want to be known by. It's something that's a part of who you are, and you want everybody to be able to see it. Because your face is typically, unless you're a real conservative Muslim or something along those lines, your face is always exposed. So you're not going to hide those things. And in the scripture, when something's on your forehead or on your right hand, it means that it's how you're being identified. Okay? On his head are blasphemous names. That lets you know that that's what his character is. The character of this tyrannical government, of anti-Christian government, is to blaspheme God. And you can see that throughout history. I mean, it's really easy to see in the communist regimes, isn't it? I mean, they specifically outlaw any religion that is not created by the state and gives homage to the state. So, you know, you can find that pretty easily throughout history if you look. Holy Roman Empire, man, Catholic Church, talk about blasphemous names, right? Written all over it, right? No hesitation. Pope is venerated, Mary is venerated and worshipped, and, you know, Catholics and Orthodox like to make a distinction between veneration and worship, but they're the same. They're the same. Verse 3, it says, "I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast." We're probably not going to get past this verse today, and because isn't this one of the famous verses that people like to take a look at and postulate on, you know? Created so many ideas and interpretations. The popular one today, well, you tell me, what have you heard as probably one of the popular versions of this today? The wound that was healed. Who is this referring to? The Antichrist, right? The Antichrist. He's going to have a, and they take all kinds of passages that are really unrelated to each other and smash them together and create this theology of the Antichrist. You know, he's going to make a firm covenant with Israel. And either somewhere before he makes the covenant or in the middle, it looks like he's going to die, possibly does die, and then resurrects, and then completely changes and turns on Israel. And, you know, all the tribulation starts, you know, all this kind of stuff. Well, it's not really what that's talking about. And we'll get into that. One of the big ones when I was growing up, when people were trying to identify who the Antichrist is, was Mikhail Gorbachev. How many of you remember Mikhail Gorbachev? The former head of the Soviet Union. He was the premier of the Soviet Union when it fell, and he became a guy that was supposedly a peaceful guy. Okay. Until he passed away, I think it was a couple of years ago, 2022, maybe, I think 2021, somewhere around there. Well, you know why Mikhail Gorbachev was this guy that had the wound healed, right? Because he had that big splotchy birthmark on top of his head. And John mistakenly took that as a wound that was healed because it looks like a wound on the head because it was all red. John just didn't know what he was looking at. And so he said it was a wound that was healed, when actually it's a birthmark. So Mikhail Gorbachev, back in the 80s and in early 90s, he was the Antichrist. All right. Another one that I heard of was Ronald Reagan. And you want to know why Ronald Reagan was? His middle name was Wilson. Ronald Wilson Reagan. Six letters in each of his names. 666. If anybody's the Antichrist, it's Ronald Reagan. Ronald Wilson Reagan. Okay, sure. If you look through history, there's all kinds of them. Some say this was Nero. Nero died by suicide in 68, and so some people are saying, oh, he came back in the form of Domitian. Well, maybe not physically, but in policy, and Domitian, you know, started the persecution of the church back, just like Nero did. Another view of this head that is healed is it's a government that Rome died, but that Rome's going to revive at the end. That's really popular when you look at more different versions of premillennialism, because in the book of Daniel, they view the fourth beast, Daniel 2, the fourth kingdom, and how it turns into another kingdom, supposedly, the way they look at it, is a revived Roman Empire. Again, the text does not support that at all. I think we've gone over Daniel 2 a few times. Not going to do that again. The traditional, I'm more in something called the amillennial camp, which means that the church is the millennial reign of Christ. So it's not literally 1,000 years. It's just denoting a nice long time. Like a lot of the books in Revelation, or a lot of the numbers in Revelation, they're symbolic of short periods of time, whole periods of time, whatever the case is, from different perspectives. And my viewpoint, and a lot of people in the Restoration Movement viewpoint, is more amillennial. Now, I'm more of a modified amillennial, because and you'll see when we get to the bowls of wrath that are poured out, I think something different of that than traditional amillennialists do, and I'll explain why. Now, if you really want to figure me out on this, you should ask me, what is my conviction level of me being certain on any of this? Okay? And some things the book of Revelation I'm pretty solid on. You know, like, I'm like 90% sure that this is what that's talking about. Some stuff, I'm like 50% sure, which means given, you know, where we're at the end of this, I might have a completely different opinion on it. But one thing I'm 100% sure of is the purpose of the book and what the main thrust is. That I'm 100% sure of, right? The main thrust, and we'll get to it more toward the end of the message too, probably today, although probably not. The main thrust of this is to make sure that no matter what we physically see with our eyes on this earth, that we stay faithful because it is not as it appears. It looks like Satan is in charge, that he's in control, that everything is working out according to plan, and that he's trying to shake the faith of the Christian, and that a lot of times people's faith is going to be shaken. But we need to be the kind of people that have a little bit more wisdom than that, that can pull the veil back, which is what Revelation, the name of the book, means, to pull the veil back and see the spiritual condition of things as they really are. And that is designed to give us faith. It's designed to give us perseverance, which chapter 13 talks about. So my viewpoint on this is that the heads represent the governments through the ages. And this verse specifically is how it might look like an anti-God tyrannical government gets defeated, but it always comes back in a different form. I mean, you look at Egypt, which I think is one of the heads here. You look at Egypt. It looks like God finally defeats Egypt, right? And they're never coming back. Well, then Assyria shows up. Then God miraculously destroys Assyria, and it's like, oh, God's people are free. Then Babylon shows up. Babylon gets defeated by the Medes and the Persians, and they have some freedom. But then you've got the plot of Haman that they have to overcome. Then Greece shows up, and it looks like they've got some freedom under Greece. And then Antiochus Epiphanes shows up, and he's absolutely talked about in the scriptures prophetically. And they get wiped out, and Rome comes on the picture, and you know, Rome gives them, you know, benign neglect for a little while, and then all of a sudden, boom, it lowers the hammer on them. See, it always seems to appear that when tyrannical anti-God governments get defeated, it's like, man, God's people finally have a respite. And they always resurrect, and they always have a lot of things in common. And the reason they have a lot of things in common is because they're run by the same guy. They're run by the dragon. And he's got a singular goal. And that goal is to persecute and to destroy as many of God's people as he can so that you don't make it. He has nothing but active malice towards you. And the faster we get that through our heads and recognize that everything that has been created in front of our eyes is designed for that purpose, we'll recognize that, man, maybe there is no such thing as anything that's neutral, you know, benign. It's actually designed to mess with us. It's actually designed to destroy us. So we have to be really careful with what we use and how we use it to make sure, you know, to the pure, all things are pure. So we can use a lot of stuff to make sure we're using it properly. And that's a big lesson through here. So let's dive into this a little bit more. It says there in verse 3, it says, I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain and his fatal wound was healed. So obviously this isn't a birthmark that John didn't, you know, see. The wording here is interesting as well. And you think, well, why would God, or why would the dragon want to have this fatal wound that's healed? Well, let's think about it this way. Doesn't Satan counterfeit everything that God does? Whenever he sees God doing something, he runs a parallel program to try to pull people away from that and get it to work. I mean, the division between the northern and southern kingdom is a prime example. You know, Rehoboam down in the south, and then you've got Jeroboam up in the north, right? And they split. What's the first thing they do in the north? The first thing the king recognizes is, if I don't fix this, they're going to keep going down to Jerusalem, and my kingdom's going to get ripped away from me, and the house of David is going to reunite the kingdom. We can't have that. So I'm going to set up a new religion. I'm going to set up a golden calf in Bethel and a golden calf in Dan, and I'm going to create our own priesthood, and we're going to call this still under the name of Yahweh. but it's going to be a separate system. Doubt's completely satanic. That looks like the lamb, but speaks like the dragon. And then eventually what happened was, is they started to morph, and it's called syncretism. They took the worship of Baal and Asherah and all of those nasty things and started incorporating it into the system of the Northern Kingdom. That worked its way into the South too. So that kind of thing happens. But then, I mean, if you notice specifically here in verse 3, what we're seeing is a counterfeit resurrection. Because if you think about it, the cross and the resurrection of Christ brings people to it. Why do you serve God? Why do you serve Jesus Christ? Because he resurrected. He's alive. If he would have stayed dead, it wouldn't have had the same effect. It probably just would have died. The apostles would have gone back to fishing and zealoting and tax collecting and all the other things that they did. And Christianity never would have started. And who knows what we'd be. We serve Christ because he resurrected, because he is alive forevermore. And so if Satan can somehow mimic that, and he'll try to do it on a bunch of different levels, he's going to have people where he wants them. So the wording here is interesting, because if you look at verse 3, it says, "I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain." The literal translation there is "as if slain unto death." Now, go back to chapter 5 in verse 6. And it says, "And I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders a lamb standing as if slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth." Same type of terminology, as if slain. I think what John's using here is similar terminology to describe a counterfeit resurrection, because that's what Satan is always interested in. Taking the things of God, duping them into something that somebody can look at and say, yeah, that's power. That's power. Again, we don't really know if this is talking about, again, I don't have a ton of confidence on this. Could this be referring to somebody in the future that this happens to? Possibly, but it's one of the heads of the beast, and it lets us know that it's more along the lines of a government of some sort. And so I think if we're talking about a specific government, I've got a hunch that we'll discuss here, but I'm not 100% certain. Let's go over to chapter 17, because chapter 17 gives us some more detail. Questions or comments so far before we move on? Okay. Not a lot to really sink your teeth into to ask a question on this so far, so I get it. Let's go to 17:7. So before we get to that, the picture so far in chapter 17 is you have the beast that comes up out of the sea, and the harlot is riding on him, and they're both dressed the same. They're all in scarlet. So it lets you know that they're similar in the way that they operate. But we'll get to that when we get to chapter 17. So verse 7, it says, "And the angel said to me," verse 7, "why do you wonder? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast which you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction." How's that for you? That's pretty solid, right? It was, it is not, and it's about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. Perfectly clear now, right? So we probably don't need to discuss it anymore. It says, "And those who dwell on the earth, whose names had not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the earth, will wonder when they see the beast, that he was and is not and will come. Here is the mind that has wisdom." Okay, phew. John's gonna explain it to us so that we have no question and we get it, right? The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. The beast which was and is not and is himself also an eighth and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. Crystal clear, right? Got it? All right, Brian's going to explain it to you. Come on, Brian. It's the black cube of Saturn. I mean, come on now. I mean, yes, Josh trying to give us some information here. Here's the mind who has wisdom. Apocalyptic prophetic literature is so hard to understand, because if you listen to people on the interwebs or, you know, on TV or growing up listening to Jack Van Impe like I did, you know, he would have his wife read from the newspaper, and he would say, oh, this is exactly what's going on in this verse and in that verse and in this verse, and mashes, you know, it's just like, let's throw verses in a blender. Let's see what kind of concoction we can come up with this week. And you always are changing your mind. Always changing your mind. Because if you use modern news as your guide for interpreting the scriptures, you're going to struggle. It's just the way it is. It's not, you're not going to have anything really solid to go by. So let's try to break this down. It says the seven mountains the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. The reader at that time would have automatically thought of Rome. Any idea why? Anybody know? It's founded on seven hills. That was actually how you referred to Rome when you try to look. I mean, it was bigger than the seven hills, but they would call Rome the seven hills of Rome. They had seven individual hills. And so the city east of the Tiber River, that's where it was founded, the seven hills of Rome. So a first century Christian reading this would have said Rome. Okay. We've got a basis here. But here's the problem. It's not just seven mountains, seven kings. And notice what it says, verse 9 or 10. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. So folks that like the historical view on this like to say that these are seven specific Roman emperors. And the one who was at that time, depending, and it's typically preterist folks that like this, they say that this is Nero, is the one who is, and the one who is to come is probably Domitian. Let's ask a question, though. Was Domitian the last emperor that came that persecuted the church? No. Many came after him persecuting the church. These are not seven kings of Rome. All right, it's just not the case. Because Rome persevered after this, the world persevered after this, tyrannical government persevered after this. I don't think that's what it's talking about. All right, it says, five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. All right, here's my idea. And I know other people share it too. Like I know Luke Wilson shares, I think Jay has the same. It's a mainline amillennial viewpoint. And I don't see any reason why it couldn't be accurate. The five that were, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medes and Persians, and Greece. The five major systems that persecuted the nation of Israel, starting from the first one, Egypt. The one who is, Rome. The one who is to come is the last anti-Christian government that will be on the earth. But this one's going to be a little bit different. Because look at what it says. Verse 11. The beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. So there's like an eighth one that comes out of the seventh one. So it's actually a little bit more than seven. It's an eighth that comes out of it, but it can trace its lineage back to the seven. So it's one of the seven. It's a little bit interesting. But then it goes a little bit further. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. So these ten kings all receive at the same time authority with the beast for 1 hour. Notice what it says. They have one purpose, and they give their power to the authority of the beast. What is the one purpose? Verse 14. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are the called, the chosen, and the faithful. This last anti-Christian government is going to have 10 kings that exist with it. And it comes out of the last one. It's a little bit separate. I think that possibly could be the wound that's healed. Okay, it's one of the seven, but is also an eight. So it comes out of it. The wound that's healed gets reorganized. The 10 kings. I don't think it's 10 individual kings. I think that the number 10 represents a number of wholeness or completion or universality, like all of one thing. I think what this represents is all of the kings of the earth at one time coming under the banner of this government and the entire world being united in trying to destroy the visible church on earth. And this is something that we see throughout the rest of Scripture, though, too. Remember chapter 11, the two witnesses? Who'd we say the two witnesses were? Scripture and the church. The two witnesses are killed. The whole earth celebrates and sends presents to each other, right? The whole earth does. In chapter 16, demons come up. They go after the kings of the earth and gather them together for the war. All of the kings of the earth come together for the final battle. In chapter 20, all of the kingdoms of the earth march up on the broad plain of the earth, surround the camp of the saints, and that's when lightning comes down or fire comes down from heaven and devours them. We're seeing it in different ways throughout the book of Revelation. I think this is another way of saying it. All of the kings of the earth are under the banner of the beast, and their singular purpose is to destroy the church. So back to Revelation chapter 13. What is the wound that's healed? Not sure. I have a hunch. And again, some other folks that I know share the same hunch. But this is where I could be at for now. If you were to ask most people in the Restoration Movement who hold to an amillennial viewpoint, has there been another kingdom on the face of the earth? They would say no, because Daniel chapter 2 states that the stone that hits the mountain or the statue turns into a mountain, destroys that kingdom, and their assumption is no other kingdom is ever going to rise again. I think Revelation and other places, Daniel 7 to be one of them, disputes that interpretation. The one kingdom that came up and existed after Rome, and I view the Catholic Church as an extension of Rome. It was headquartered in Rome. Holy Roman Empire, right? And then it moved over to the Eastern Roman Empire, but it's still the Holy Roman Empire. And it controlled the world, didn't it? It ordained the kings of the nations. So I think that's part of it. The kingdom that came up after that, very possibly could be Britain, could be England. Remember what this, remember the saying? The sun never sets on the British Empire. That was true. Their empire was all the way around the world. And could that have been the wound that, or the fatal wound was America coming up out of that and restoring the gospel and bringing the peace of the gospel to every continent, essentially, on the face of the earth? I mean, do you guys realize that every single place that the true plan of salvation has spread around the world in modern times has come from America? That's fascinating. Because it was here that it was reestablished. In Lisbon, Ohio. And it spread throughout the country. A lot of people don't understand. Maybe we ought to do a small series on restoration history. Most people don't realize the impact that the restoration movement had on the eastern United States in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. I mean, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, were converted through the preaching of the true gospel. That could have been the fatal wound to the tyrannical beast. Again, these are hunches. Okay. But that fatal wound was busy being healed almost immediately. I mean, what happens 90 years after the founding of America? Country almost split in two, didn't it? What happened 50 years, 40, 50 years after the Civil War? The administration of Woodrow Wilson. Go back and look at that and see how, I mean, quite honestly, that was probably the nail in the coffin, was his administration. Our sovereignty is essentially eroded and gone. Our freedom. Now, we live in the part of America where the wound has been being healed and healed and healed. Again, this is just a hunch. And possibly the beast is ready to revive. Now, we could lament and say, man, I wish I was born in this time frame or that time frame and, you know, only experienced the golden age of America or whatever the case is. And that probably wouldn't be a bad thing. But you know what? God has chosen you and me to be alive at this time for this purpose, for this reason. Because he wants you here. At this time, for this reason. And for us, we should just say, wow, that's pretty cool. Thank you, Lord. We get to live in a time frame that is becoming increasingly hostile. And who knows how long it takes for the wound to get healed, for the beast to revive. And, you know, again, this is all hunch. I could be completely and utterly dead wrong on this. But the scripture does seem to indicate that there is going to be one last worldwide anti-Christian government that singular purpose is to wage war against the Lamb and try to destroy every semblance of the church. And I think the things are being put in place for that exact thing to happen. I don't think it could have happened before the rise of the surveillance state. And the interconnectedness that comes through technology and data. I mean, you have someone in a control room somewhere that could ask the question, you know, hey, where's Debbie Akers right now? No, I know you're right there. But somebody in the control room somewhere could say, where's Debbie Akers? Oh, let's geolocate her on her phone. Oh, she's sitting at the American Legion in Mechanicsville on Bell Creek Road. Yeah, we need to go get her. Go get her right now. And they could come here and find her and take her away like that. No, they won't do that, Debbie. Not yet, so don't worry. They could do the same thing for you. You know, most of your vehicles have that tracking ability in them, especially the new ones. I was getting my car serviced the other day at Toyota, and they had a nice RAV4 out there. $55,000 for a RAV4. Are you kidding me? It's a RAV4, okay? Anyway, there's this little camera on the top of the steering wheel or the steering column that is always looking at you. Do you know what its purpose is? To see if you are able to drive or not. It's constantly looking at your eyes, seeing if you're able to drive or not. If it's not, it'll shut the car off. So you better hope that you don't like get attacked or you're having a heart attack or are just crying about something because your car might not move. Your cars, you know, like my vehicle, even though it's a 2019, my RAV, has wireless on it. It's relaying information back to Toyota. It's got microphones. It's got cameras. That's an 8-year-old vehicle. Well, not 8, 7. So even if you, like, oh, man, you know what? I'm not going to have a cell phone. Unless you've got, like, an old vehicle that they can't track, you're going to be tracked. I mean, but I think everybody has some. Your TVs can listen to you. I mean, anything that's plugged in now can listen to you. No, they're going to know exactly where you are. Data centers? I mean, Elon's going to put data centers in space, man. He wants to put enough data centers in space so that, you know, we don't need them here on Earth. Like a million of them. They're not going away. They're tracking you all of the time. Now, we could say, oh, these are, you know, these are private corporations and everything's going to be just fine because it's private information. Elon has this huge data center somewhere. I think it's in Tennessee, maybe. And I can't remember what it's called. It's got a name. I'll research it. Google and one other company. It might be Apple. I don't know. But I know Google. Think about this number. Rents space at that data center for $1.5 billion a day. A day to have access to the data that Elon is collecting from places like X and Starlink and Tesla's and everything else, and for them also to get their data in from all the Google users that are out there. You know, when Jaden had his car accident, he wasn't using Google Maps. And because because Google Maps sensed a sudden stop, it called 911. Because it's tracking him the whole time, even if you're not using it. Now, that's one thing I was really glad that it did. Called 911, ambulance came out, police came out. They were there within like 30 seconds. Because police live on Broad Street and Shore Pump. My point is, we could say, government having access to all this information, if you don't got nothing to hide, then you don't got nothing to worry about. That's true if government was benign. What do we know about government from the scripture? It's a beast. It's a beast. At least it has beastly tendencies. And even if it was peaceful at one time, it's kind of getting more beastly as we look at it, isn't it? My point is, I'm not trying to like scare people. I'll just be aware. Have the information. Live your life accordingly. Live your life with purpose. Based on what God would want you to do in these types of situations, and make the most of the opportunity, make the most of our time, make the most of the day. Be productive for the kingdom. You know, going to work and being a good citizen, that's being productive for the kingdom, because you're out there meeting people and talking to people and making contacts. I know a lot of the contacts we have are from folks that you're seeing and meeting at work. That's a great thing. But what I'm saying is, the ability for these things to kind of happen now, we're somewhat at an unprecedented place in history where people are able to be tracked nonstop down to a few feet of where you exist. And if that information ever wanted to be weaponized, that'd be really effective, wouldn't it? Now, what's interesting is we're not going to get there today. There's a little bit of encouragement in chapter 13. And I'll just like read it to you, and then maybe you can study it out a little bit. Because if you study it out a little bit, you'll, especially the manuscript evidence, the different variant readings, it's pretty cool. But it says here, verse 8, all who dwell on the earth will worship him. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. We're going to break that down, and maybe next week, maybe the week after. But when he ever tells you that here's the perseverance and the faith of the saints, that'd probably be something we should pay attention to, right? Especially when he's talking about persecution. He's talking about making it. All right, we're going to go ahead and stop there.